Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Your brain needs support, and new Ollie Brainy Chews are a delightful way to take care of your cognitive health. Made with scientifically backed ingredients like Thai ginger, L-theanine, and caffeine, Brainy Chews support healthy brain function and help you find your focus, stay chill, or get energized. Be kind to your mind and get these nootropic chews at Ollie.com. That's Olly.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Hi, everyone, and thank you for tuning in to the 501st episode of the Hollywood Reporter's Awards Chatter Podcast. I'm the host, Scott Feinberg, and my guest today is a top young actress and producer who is coming off the biggest year of her career so far. Since establishing herself in comedies on screens big and small, in particular on the NBC sitcom Parks and Recreation, on which she played the key supporting part of April Ludgate, an apathetic intern, for 7 seasons spanning 2009 through 2015, she has, to quote the New York Times, continually reinvented herself, and, to quote the Los Angeles Times, emerged as a performer of surprising depth and range, and a creative force to be reckoned with behind the camera, too. Indeed, this year, Amy Poehler described her as one of the most interesting actors working today, and Time magazine selected her as one of the 100 most influential people in the world. The star and producer of John Patton Ford's acclaimed 2022 independent film Emily the Criminal, and a standout supporting actress on the second season of Mike White's massively popular 2022 HBO drama series The White Lotus, Aubrey Plaza. Over the course of our conversation, the 38-year-old and I discussed how she was changed by a freak stroke that she suffered at the age of just 21. The insane first week that she spent in L.A., during which she landed her parts in Funny People, Scott Pilgrim vs. the World, and Parks and Rec, the sense of resentment that she felt for a time about being regarded by some as a good fit only for deadpan characters like April, whether she, having twice hosted the Spirit Awards, would like to one day host the Oscars, some dish about two of her upcoming projects, Disney Plus's WandaVision spinoff Agatha, Coven of Chaos, and Francis Ford Coppola's self-financed final film Megalopolis, plus much more. And so, without further ado, let's go to that conversation. Aubrey, thank you so much for doing the podcast. Great to have you. And on this podcast, we always begin truly at the beginning. I wonder if you can just share for our listeners, where were you born and raised, and what did your folks do for a living?
Hello. Thanks for having me, Scott. I was born in Wilmington, Delaware, at the Wilmington General Hospital, I believe, or Wilmington Hospital. And my parents have had a lot of jobs over the years, but when I was born, my mom was putting herself through night school to become a lawyer. And she did, in fact, become a lawyer. So she is a lawyer. But she worked all kinds of jobs, when I was growing up, putting herself through school and all that. And then my dad is a financial advisor. I believe that there's a lot of funny stories about their jobs. But I believe at one point when they were young, they were both working at a local Wawa. And I think my mom was, if you're from the East Coast, you know what a Wawa is.
But that's right.
My mom was like the manager of a Wawa. And I think my dad worked underneath her at some point. Anyway, they had all kinds of crazy jobs. But lawyer and stockbroker is the answer.
Yeah. And I mean, I guess they were unusually young when you came along, right? That I wonder, how do you think that impacted, shaped you as a kid?
Yes, they were. My mom got pregnant with me when she was 19, and had me at 20. I think she was 20 when I came out. And I think it has so much to do with who I am and kind of my experience of having young parents. And but young was one thing, but also just kind of growing up watching my parents just hustle, you know, mm-hmm. like they were so ambitious and just it was very inspiring, I think, for me to grow up around and watch your parents kind of go from nothing, you know, to having like these kind of amazing careers. And it was, yeah. And I think it shaped me a lot, because I think when I was first born, you know, we lived kind of in a really kind of small apartment. And there's one story that my mom, I think is true, which, and I have this like memory of it, but I think it might be like a mix of, maybe it's just because people have told me, but it was right. like, I was in a crib and they were sleeping on a mattress on the floor. I have this like memory of that, but I don't know if it's a real memory or not, but yeah. So I think watching them, you know, I don't know, hustle their way through life was very, very, very much shaped who I am. I think I had that kind of hustle approach mentality in my blood, my DNA.
And it's interesting, because obviously the character that most people first got to know you as was sort of the exact opposite of a hustler, right? Like somebody who's
yes.
kind of phoning it in. And so yet, in fact, I guess in your life, you've noted, you know, because people sometimes, I don't know why, but I guess there's an assumption they think that the character is also the actor, which it sounds like as a kid was very much not, you know, you're not April, you were pretty different, right?
Yeah, I think I was very different. I think that happens a lot. I mean, I take it as a compliment when people just assume that you are your character. I think it's kind of a compliment in some ways, because you're yeah. like, well, I must be doing a great job if they believe this is a real person.
Right.
But of course, there are a lot of things that are similar. But yeah, I'm definitely, growing up, I was never phoning it in. I was very much participating in all kinds of activities and very much a leader and motivated and more, way more probably type A and than people would think.
And
the characters that I play.
And so where along the line, and I guess, why does acting enter the picture? It seems like there were a lot of other interests and hobbies and things going on. Why, I guess, with community theater or something, why did that first begin?
Why did community theater begin?
Well, how did you, I mean, what led to you getting involved in the first place with that?
Oh, I followed my cousin, Lindsay, my older cousin. I'm the oldest of three sisters. So I never had like an older sibling. And so she was kind of like my older sibling, and I kind of, you know, just thought she was so cool and wanted to do whatever she did. And she started doing plays at the Wilmington Drama League, which is a community theater where I grew up. And I went to see her do that at a, probably, I don't remember how old I was, maybe like 11, 11-ish. And I just remember going into the drama league, and they were holding auditions for a play, and all the kids were sitting on the floor. And the way they were doing the auditions was everybody had to, when it was your turn, you had to stand up in front of everybody and do your audition, either sing a song or do your little monologue or something. And I just remember sitting in the back and watching that and going, oh my gosh, like these kids, they're so brave. Like they don't care at all what they look like. They just are getting up there in front of everybody and doing this thing. And there was just something that I thought was so cool about that and so freeing. And I think I was a slightly shy child before that. And then I think, I don't know. I just there was something about trying to do that it really got me going. And then I decided I'm going to audition too, and I'm going to go for it. I fell in love with the theater at that point. And I spent most of that, my middle school, high school years doing plays at the Drama League and being very, very active in that community. I think I just felt like I had found my people there you know, at all sure. the, because there was no school, it wasn't affiliated with the school. So it was just people that were gravitating towards theater and artists. And I think I just found out, like, at a young age, like, oh, wow, this feels like where I fit in.
And was that also where improv entered the picture? Because I think I read that you were doing that, even there was maybe a bit of a commute to go and do that as early as high school, right?
Yes, I started improv in high school in Philadelphia. I found some, I became very into sketch comedy and improv early, you know, Miss, you know, Kids in the Hall and the Upright Citizens Brigade Theater, the sketch show, and all those kinds of things were, I was really into. And so I found some improv theaters in Philly, and I would drive up there and do those classes, like probably around 15, 16 is when I started doing that. Yeah.
And when you eventually go off, I know to NYU Tisch, like at that point, has a decision already been made that, you know, hey, I'm going to pursue acting or comedy, or were you just open to whatever, you know, see where that might lead at that point?
I was very strategic from a young age. I felt I was very, very, very obsessed with Saturday Night Live. And it was a dream of mine to be on that show, as I'm sure it is for so many people, because I grew up on that show. And I just remember researching how the cast members got on that show. And then, but ultimately, with the ultimate goal for me was to act, you know, in movies. I love movies more than anything. And there were so many people on that show that I felt that were very inspiring to me, because they were comedians and they were doing sketch comedy, but then they would kind of do movies and do dramas. Like Adam Sandler was someone that I've always looked up to. I love his career. And at a young age, I just was, to me, that was the ultimate, like what he does is kind of like, I was like, he has it all, you know?
Yeah.
So I had a plan. My plan was to do improv comedy and hopefully, you know, audition for SNL, get on SNL, and then do movies. So my plan didn't work out exactly like that, but I'm happy with how it worked out. But
yeah. And
that was my thinking.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, the fact is that it came pretty close to SNL. I know we'll get to there in a minute chronologically, but just while you're at NYU, so you're doing now in New York some stuff with UCB, right? And I mean, we actually just had the last episode was John Mulaney. I think he said he remembers you from there, right?
Yeah. Oh yeah, Mulaney was so funny. Yeah, I used to watch all those shows.
So there's UCB, then you're, I guess this is early days of broadband or whatever. You're also involved with an online series while you're at NYU. Is that right?
Yeah, I was. Well, I was, you know, I was taking classes at UCB, doing live shows at night, and I was around at the time when kind of web series were first starting out, and I was cast in the Jeannie Tate Show, which is I'm assuming that's the one you're talking
about.
Yeah,
but
that So I was in a class. I was in class with Maggie Carey, and she had created this show with Liz Gutkowski, who was a writer on Saturday Night Live at that time, and with Bill Hader as well. So they cast me as kind of this teenage delinquent kind of daughter of Liz Gutkowski's character, Jeannie Tate. And that kind of became like an early kind of iteration of April Ludgate. It was kind of the first time that I'd done a character like that. I credit that web series a lot, because I think that's kind of how, that was the first kind of thing that got me out there. I think some junior comedy agents had seen it, and because there were some notable people on it, and it really helped kind of, yeah, get my stuff out there.
So I know that, I believe it's between your junior and senior year over the summer, something pretty crazy happened, which I didn't know about certainly until I started prepping for this, but I imagine it's got to have a pretty major effect on a person. And that is that you had a stroke. I guess I just wonder, did you ever figure out kind of I mean, thank God, it seems like, you know, you clearly bounced back. But did you ever figure out what caused that? And how do you think it changed you, not even in terms of health, but just outlook and goals? I would imagine it could really jar a person.
Yeah, so I think it's always, unfortunately, going to be a slight mystery in terms of what caused it. There's definitely theories. I think the strongest theory is that it was caused by ortho-tricycline, which is the birth control pill, one of the types of birth control pills. That was the only really thing that I had put into my body that was like new in my system at that time. And I was 20, so I was really young. And, you know, they have warnings on those things that say it's possible, you know, but it's usually like one in a million chance that it could happen. So I guess I'm that statistic, nice. but so it's scary. Yeah. I've never taken hormones again. Really freaked out by that stuff now. But you know, it's not 100%, you know, positive that caused it, but it feels like it was, but I think it changed me a lot. I mean, I think it was really like a near-death experience, and I'm so fascinated by reading about near-death experiences and kind of like understanding like what happens to people right before they die. And there were certain physical things that happened to me that I've read about in other books when people have had kind of near-death experiences or they've died and then come back to life. Like there's some similar stuff that went on, so it's all kind of fascinating to me. I think maybe on an unconscious level, like it's shaped me in just a way that where I feel like I always have an underlying kind of feeling that life is short, that things, you know, could be taken away from you in a second. I mean, just out of nowhere. So I think maybe that dictates how I kind of live my life sometimes, for better or for worse. Sometimes I have that kind of attitude where I'm just like, you know, there's a lot more going on. I think also when I had this stroke, it's a really weird sensation because your brain is not working, but you're still, there's still some kind of consciousness that's happening. And so it was very, very interesting to me because I realized when looking back on it, that it taught me that there is you and then there's your brain. Mm-hmm. And because me, whatever that is, whatever me is, was fully aware of everything that was happening when I had the stroke. And the me was going, uh-oh, like I can't talk. My brain isn't working. I can't say the words that I want to say right now. But when you really think about that, you're like, wow, that's pretty amazing that there's something else going on. I don't know what it is, your soul or your you. So it's kind of trippy to think about, but I think like all that stuff has always been really interesting to me since that happened.
Oh, it's fascinating. And it does seem like maybe because you were so young when it happened, you were able to kind of bounce back pretty quickly and fully, right?
Yes. Yes. Thankfully. So thankfully, I think my brain was elastic. I was very young, so I don't have a lot of residual problems.
I don't know if this next thing, not to go from heavy to light, but I mean, I think that you, I think that around that same time might have been a little bit before, might have been a little after, but your association with NBC, I guess, kind of began there, right? You were just, this is a, mm-hmm. I think a trivia thing that came up when you hosted SNL, but what was going on? Like, how did you, what were you doing there? And then eventually I think it did kind of culminate in an audition for SNL that, you know, it's kind of the realization of what you said you'd been thinking about all along as a kid, right?
Yeah. Well, I got an internship at Saturday Night Live through school. And I was an intern in the design department, which was a set design, which was working for the set designers. So I wasn't, doing, you know, like a creative internship or anything for them. But it was really cool because I got to be there. I got to understand how the show worked and I got to, you know, be there all hours of the night. And I took advantage of the opportunity for sure. I read all the sketches, all the scripts, and just observed, you know, tried to absorb as much as I could. But it's very different when you're in that position than when you're like, you know, being on the show or being considered to be on the show. At that point, I was not at all. I think I was just like so lucky to be there. And then I think timing wise, yeah, I guess it was pretty soon after that that I started getting some more acting opportunities, and I was kind of preparing my audition for the show. And I kind of was along with a bunch of other people at UCB at that time, and they kind of had preliminary auditions. They would do kind of preliminary like showcases at the theater, and then if you made it through that level, then you would eventually, if you would make it to the Studio 8H audition, which is like the classic one that everybody kind of knows about. I never made it that far, but at least I got to do like one of the preliminary showcases.
Absolutely. Do you remember, was there a highlight of kind of your audition there? Anything that stands out about what you did or how people reacted or anything like that?
Oh my gosh. My memory is so bad. I don't remember anything, but I do remember I did an impression of Sarah Silverman that kind of was like, you know, one of the impressions that I had done. I believe I did a Joy Behar impression. I can't remember the other ones, but it's funny because at that time when you were doing comedy stuff, it was a new thing to kind of throw your stuff up on YouTube. Yes. Not knowing that it would just continue to have this life that you didn't ask for. But I remember years later, people would bring up the Sarah Silverman impression and go like, I can't believe you did that Sarah Silverman impression. I'm like, oh no, that was just for like an audition. I wasn't like going around to clubs doing it. But like, yeah. And then I did a bunch of characters, and I think one of the characters I did was like this talk show host, and I made a show called Celebrity Tales where I would just name celebrities and name like the kind of animal tales they would have. And it was just really silly right. stuff. But
so that was, I believe, in 08. In 09 is when I think people first really started seeing you in a bunch of stuff pretty much all at once. And the story of how that happened is pretty mind blowing. I'm sure it must drive crazy any other actors who you share it with. And I just wonder if you can talk about it. I believe you're 22 and you take your first trip to LA. What were the circumstances that led to that trip, and what went on in I think a week, like just a lot of stuff happened in a week, right?
Yeah, so basically I went through the process of auditioning for Funny People. I made a tape, a self-tape, which is funny, weird trivia is that Donald Glover actually filmed that tape for me and helped me with my audition and was playing the part of Seth Rogen's character on the other end of the camera. Because we filmed it, we actually filmed my audition when we were shooting Mystery Team, which was the first movie I was ever in, which is Donald Glover's sketch group. And so we filmed that audition while we were shooting on set, and Donald helped me, and it turned out they loved the tape, but the character was a stand-up comedian, so they wanted to cast someone that really does stand-up, which I was not doing at the time. I was only doing improv and sketch, but I just thought, okay, well, fuck it. I'm just going to be a stand-up comedian. I can do that. And so I went up I think it was Donald Glover's, I think he had like a open mic night kind of thing in Long Island City. I can't remember what the club was called, but I think he let me get up there and do like 5 minutes, and I had my friend tape it. And I kind of wrote jokes in the style of what I thought the character was in the film, so it was more of like an acting exercise for me. And I sent that tape in, and very quickly they loved it too, and they just decided they wanted me to come to LA and do a chemistry read with Seth Rogen as kind of the final step of the process. And so at that time I didn't really have representations like so much in terms of agents, but I went out and Allison Jones, who is the casting director on Funny People, she just really took a liking to me. And she asked me if I could maybe do some other meetings that she would send me on. And I was like, sure, I'll do whatever you want. and so then she sent me to meet Greg Daniels and Mike Schur, who were at that time kind of developing the Parks and Rec script. And then she sent me into a director's session, which is an audition, which means like you're auditioning for the director for Scott Pilgrim versus the World. And so, which I didn't even also realize I had skipped a bunch of steps and gone right into the director's session on that one too. So it was just, it was like three really kind of huge things that I did. And then I eventually found out I got all three of them, which was a complete like shock. And it doesn't happen like that. It's a really weird, I don't know what's going on that week. I was wearing jean shorts. And I don't know. I think it was just like, I had no idea how big of a deal these meetings were. And so maybe there was an element of like, it seemed like I didn't care so much, or I don't know, but it worked out, whatever that was.
I was going to say, I mean, maybe it's the fact that, and certainly I guess in the case of Parks and Rec, the fact that you weren't super impressed with the whole thing seems to have worked in your favor, right? I mean, I guess maybe if we can just quickly tackle them one by one. Funny People, just so to remind folks, Judd Apatow and your man Sandler, who you've talked about caring, you know, being a big admirer, you're playing the stand-up who's sort of the love interest of Rogan's character. I guess the story is basically essentially, you know, inspired by Judd's life. Your character, I think, was modeled on Janine Garofalo, who he'd worked with when he was younger. So There you're in that comedy, like Judd's comedy world for the first time, and his stock company and whatever. Any just major takeaway from that one?
From being in Judd's,
yeah, just like what,
world,
yeah, the, yeah, the, or just that yeah. film. Yeah.
I mean, so like, you know, I had done nothing. I had done Mystery Team, which was a very different film than Funny People. Funny People was like a $80 million movie that Janusz Kaminski was shooting. I mean, Sandler was the star of it. Sandler hadn't done stand-up, I don't think, in like 20 years or something. So it was like it was just crazy. I mean, the biggest like takeaway that I had was just like everybody was so nice to me. Sandler really looked out for me. You know, he would come up to me on set. I had no idea what was going on. You know, he would come up to me on set and go like, you know, you good? You good? Like, you need anything? Like, everything going all right? And, you know, I'd be like, yeah, man, I don't know. I just keep my head down, try not to get fired.
Right.
And I just remember, you know, like everyone was cool. Like Jonah Hill, Seth Rogen, Jason Schwartzman, those guys just really, they took me under their wing. And I had really never experienced Hollywood or LA before. I didn't know what was going on. So all those guys are just so grounded, and they're just normal, sweet guys. And so I got really lucky, because I didn't know, you know, how my experience would be, but I felt like I hit the jackpot. I was like, this is the most amazing crew to be welcoming me into Hollywood.
Yeah.
So it was all positive. It was just, it was a literal dream come true. And, yeah.
And I guess chronologically, the next thing would be, Parks and Rec, although the pilot might've been actually, no, maybe the pilot's before, and then you, but whatever, I guess just to tee that one up here.
I think I shot Funny People first, and then I went right into shooting the pilot. I'm pretty sure.
Okay.
Am I wrong about that? But I think the weird thing was that Parks and Rec aired first. So I think I had shot Funny People first, but then Parks and Rec aired on television first. So that seemed to be the first thing that people saw me in, because that just, it just got out there faster, I think.
Interesting. Well, just in case anyone is, you know, living under a rock, for Parks and Rec, April Ludgate, described by Ron Swanson as both aggressively mean and apathetic, the whole package, sort of apathetic intern. This is 7 seasons, I believe it was in total for you guys.
Yeah.
But it started, you know, as we say, you came out of that week in LA and got it. But I mean that the version of the I want to get your version of how you ended up actually cast, because I think originally they were essentially casting you to play or interested in you to literally play yourself, essentially. You know, I think it was literally called Aubrey. So how did you even kind of wind up in the room with these guys who I think at the time were still dealing with The Office, right? And then this character, where did it come from?
I mean, Mike sure has a version of this story that I'm like, it's like, again, my memory is so bad. I'm sure he has a better memory than me and he understands, but he describes our meeting as like, I met the weirdest person I've ever met in my life. I'm like, what did I do that was so weird? But it doesn't take much to weird Mike Schur up. But yes, they were working on The Office. So the cool thing for me at that time was I was a huge fan of The Office.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what season they were on, but their offices were at the office set, which was like somewhere in the valley or something. So I had driven out there and I was just kind of on the set, and I was so overwhelmed by the fact that I was near famous people, that I was on a set that they're shooting The Office. I kept looking in the hallway going, oh my God, like Mindy Kaling just walked by and BJ Novak just walked by. Like I'm seeing all these people going like, I can't believe I'm here. This is crazy. That was what I was mainly focused on. But then I think Mike was like asking me questions and I didn't really know what I was supposed to say because I had never been on a general meeting before. So I didn't really know, like, I'm supposed to be selling myself here. Like I'm wearing jean shorts. Like I was just a tourist at that point. I was doing tourist stuff. In fact, I think I had been driving around trying to find like Judy Garland's house or something. And then Greg Daniels came into the meeting, and then I don't know what happened. Then it definitely got weird, I think, because Greg is he's such a fun weirdo. And I think we started talking about like the meaning of life and what happens after you die. And it just started getting like really heavy. And like, I don't know, I just remember like Greg and I were sitting there having some kind of crazy, like existential, like conversation. And then Mike was just like staring at us going like, what am I watching here? And then we started talking about the show. And I think I remember like, they hadn't completely written the pilot yet, but they were saying that, oh yeah, we were thinking that Leslie Knope, you know, might have like an assistant kind of character. And at that time, you know, I had just done a bunch of internships. And like I said before, I have 2 younger sisters. So I was around kind of like teenagers at that time. And I had done the Jeannie Tate show. And I knew that that kind of vibe was funny. And I think I just kind of pitched to them like, you know, what if the assistant was like, you know, really smart and really good at her job, but like does not give a shit about working there, just wants the college credit and is like the opposite of Leslie Knope, where she's just like rolling her eyes the whole time, but she's good at her job. I was like, right. I kind of pitched them that, not thinking like it was they were going to take me seriously. And then, yeah. And then the next thing I know, I got a call and they said like, you're casting the show. And that was it. And then I was like, what? And then they sent me the original script, and yes, it did. The character's name was Aubrey, I believe, in the very, very, very original pilot script, which I think I have somewhere in a vault somewhere. And then they said, well, you know, we're going to change the character's name to April, because it can't be literally your name. And also NBC wants you to audition for them so they can see you do this character. And I'm like, Okay, so they can see me do myself. But I mean, it was a character. It was definitely a character, but it was like, I don't know. So then I did. And I believe that's also like on YouTube or something, but it was just funny to me because I'm like, I've never auditioned to play myself before. It's hilarious. Thank God I got the part. It would have been really weird if I didn't.
That's like, yeah, we're looking for an Aubrey Plaza type, and then there you are.
Right.
But I have to ask you about, because I know you have come to, I don't know if hate is too strong a word, but the word deadpan, right, is always has often been used. And it sounds like from the way you're describing it, like that was part of what you suggested here. But I read one thing where you said, when you were asked about, you know, that persona, which even you, I think, have made fun of, like at the SAG Awards this year with Jenna Ortega, right? That was part of that. Just like the, but you said, quote, if I really want to psychoanalyze myself, it could be just like, or could be like just a defense mechanism. I prefer to just kind of live my life like I'm going to die any minute or something. I don't want to take anything too seriously, close quote. So it sort of kind of comes back, I guess, to what, you know, you were talking about after the stroke. But this, how quickly did you come to maybe resent that was what people thought, that was like the extent of your range for a while?
I don't know. I mean, I can't recall, but I just know that I think I always wanted to do movies. I always wanted to do different characters, and I was so lucky to get cast on a television show, but I never in my wildest dreams expected to be on a sitcom that would go on for 7 years and that would have so many episodes. And I'm so thankful it did, because I got so much set experience on that show. I mean, it's just, you learn so much by being on a set day after day for so long. But I think, like, I would say after a couple of years of doing the show, I got, you know, I had that kind of itch where the minute I was on hiatus, I was doing movies. I was like, I gotta do movies. I gotta do other characters, because people don't know that I can do other things because they're seeing me in their living room, like, doing this every day. So of course they think that's all I can do. So I think, you know, I think at first there was a time when I felt like kind of bitter about it, where I was like, no, like that's a character, you know? But then I think it's all wrapped up in these like talk show appearances that I would do as well, because I think I always had a kind of funny approach to doing talk shows because I'm a comedian. So right. I never understood the idea of going on television and doing a bit, or not trying to make it funny, or not trying to make it interesting in some way. It's just, goes against how I am. So to me, that's just another opportunity for performance. And I know it's like, once you're aware of what people expect of you, there's some part of me that, you know, I don't know if it is a defensive mechanism or if it's just, you know, I don't know, but I think there is a part of me that's just goes, I know what everybody wants. I'm going to give them what they want. Right. You know, it's better for everybody. but maybe I did that too many times. But I think I think it's like, I don't mind the persona. I don't mind any of that. And it's deeply, you know, connected to who I am. But I think there was a time that I had a bitterness kind of about being just like put in a box, this deadpan box or whatever you want to call it. But I fought very hard and to kind of get out of that.
And I was going to say, as we talk
after I have, I, yeah.
So. No, just you know, I'm going to mention a few of the movies you've done since and other things that have obviously, you know, blown that idea to smithereens, that was, you know, the limits of it. But just one last thing about, Parks and Rec, just because this is obviously a big chunk of your life. You've said that Amy Poehler and Rashida Jones kind of became very important in your, not just at work, but in your life. You've said that, you know, as you just said here, like, you know, the experience is invaluable, what you can learn from just working that much. But I just wondered, looking back at it, it must have been a bit of an emotional roller coaster just being associated with the show, because critics loved it. The people who knew about it loved it, but it was always this, it feels like it was always on the brink of cancellation and extinction. And just so like, what was the issue there? Why do you think it had to go through its life in, you know, kind of in that way? Was that just people going into it thinking they're getting The Office and then they're jarred by, or I don't want to put words in your mouth. Just, I wonder if you have a theory about
that.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that, look, like television to me, it's like, I think that, it takes time. It takes time to find the characters and to lock into kind of characters sometimes. And that this is what I'm so deeply like saddened about the state of television today and with all the streaming services, because they don't take the time to let characters develop over multiple seasons. Like a lot of times they'll do one season or two seasons and they're like, okay, we're good. We got enough. We're good. Moving on. But Parks and Rec is a great example of why if you let shows, you know, have more than two seasons, you start to get into the really good stuff because you, and I mean, of course you have to have all the other elements in place. You have to have funny actors and really good actors and really great writing and all that. But I think it's a combination of those things. And I think that Parks and Rec definitely was up against a lot of expectations in the beginning because of The Office, because of Polar coming off of SNL. And there were, you know, and I think it took a minute to lock into it. And I think the first season, it's like, you can tell, it's like, we're working it out. We're all kind of figuring out our dynamics. And it's still funny and it's still good, but it doesn't really start to just fucking go like probably until the next season, end of the next season or something. I don't remember. Mm-hmm. It's been years since I watched it, but
right.
I think it takes time, I think, sometimes to develop it. And I think if you allow it to have that time, it can be transcendent. But I think, I think also, you know, yeah, I don't know. It did feel like that. It always felt like we were kind of the underdog. You know, we were never, our ratings were never that good. But I think that part of that fueled us. You know,
yeah.
I think there was an element of that too, that was really great, because we all had to kind of go season by season feeling like this could be it. This could be it. We could be done with. And we all loved each other and had so much fun that we didn't want it to end. So I think it was kind of, that was probably part of why we kept going so strong. Nobody was phoning it in. You know, we were just,
right.
We were just going for it until the end.
So you mentioned, and we have to note that during these off seasons, or hiatuses, you guys were, you were branching out. And I think the first big example of that would have probably been Safety Not Guaranteed. This is in 2012, another intern, but a very different situation. And this mm-hmm. is produced by the Duplass brothers. I guess the first time you're offered something without even having to audition in any way. Right. And just, did you feel like that was sort of a turning point in terms of just maybe showing a different side of yourself as an actress?
Definitely. That was my first leading role. That was my first kind of like starring role in a movie. So it felt like a really big deal for me, because if, you know, it felt like, okay, like this is the first time that my character will really be shouldering kind of the emotional journey of this film, and obviously along with Mark Duplass too, but like, and Jake Johnson, but, and Karin Soni. I'll just name all the cast. But I think, yeah, it was a bit huge deal for me. It was kind of going, you know, and there was, I think, going through the process of shooting that style of movie. Obviously there was a script, but there was of course like improv involved, and just a lot of development. And it was the first time that I really went through the process with my acting coach, Ivana Chubbuck. It was kind of the first time that I got to present like, okay, here's this full journey that I'm going to go on, this full arc. How do I map this out? How do I do this? So it was a huge learning process for me. And then I think just all the people involved were so great. It felt like we had lightning in a bottle, kind of. And the Sundance experience on that film was was really, really incredible. And I don't know, just it felt very organic. Just all kind of came into place.
Next one I'm going to mention, I guess, came out after Parks and Rec. I don't know when it started production, but this is another just kind of great little indie that I think showed another side of you, which is Ingrid Goes West. This is, you're playing this mentally disturbed woman who's obsessed with and starts stalking an Instagram influencer. I think that there's a dramatic side to this character that, you know, I think maybe, again, by just because of TV and the way it works and whatever, there was, everybody knew you could do comedy. I don't know if they knew that you could necessarily do the dramatic stuff as well. And I wonder if, and maybe also an early time that you're a producer as well, right? I don't know if maybe you hadn't done that before. I can't remember where it would have begun.
So that was technically, that was my second producing credit. My first producing credit was The Little Hours. But I'll say, you know, I was not as much of a hands-on producer on The Little Hours as I was on Ingrid Goes West. Ingrid Goes West was the first film that I read the script and met with the director and just was very much like, I want to produce this movie. Like, you know, I want to be involved in every step of it, from the very beginning to the very end. And I was very, 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 involved in just every part of it. And so I learned a lot on that movie, about producing. And I think tonally, yeah, it was just, that was what was exciting about it to me. I was like, these are the kind of movies that I like. They're funny, but they're also dramatic. They're also, they've got it all. They've got a lot going on. And my goal for that film was like, I want to make a great film. I want to be good in the movie, but I want to make a great film. I want to make a film that people want to watch more than once, that people remember. I thought a lot about King of Comedy when we made that movie. I thought a lot about, you know, To Die For. I just thought of movies, that classic films that I'm just like, I want to make a movie like that. Independent films are so hard to make great. You can make a good one, but it's hard to make a really, really great one. And so my brain was kind of firing on all cylinders on that one. And I think, looking back on that film, it's like, the cast was just incredible in that movie. And I think like it taught me a lot about casting. It taught me a lot about casting. It's just like, man, casting is so important. If you can really nail the casting, it's like you're already ahead of the game.
Yeah. Next one, flashing forward just 3 years, but Black Bear, I know was a grind, you know, a grueling one for probably a number of reasons, but just if anyone needs a log line, essentially, and it's not easy to summarize, or I'm not even confident that I'm getting it, you know, having seen it, I'm not confident that I'm teasing it properly, but basically filmmaker staying at a lake house and an actress in a film being shot at the same lake house, but in two parts where you don't know is which one is actually necessarily inspiring the other, and just a mind fuck, as you've described it. Anything you'd want to add about that one?
Well, again, casting, you know, there was a lot of, things, there were a lot of requirements that I had for me to do that film because, I knew how hard it was going to be reading the script. Lawrence Michael Levine, who wrote the script and directed the film, wrote a beautiful script and, but a really scary script for me. And I just felt like, wow, I got to be in really good hands here. And I knew about Christopher Abbott prior to that script. And I had a feeling about him. I love watching him. And I felt like that's my guy. Like I want to work with him. I feel like I'm in really good hands with him. And I don't know, that movie to me was, it had a very kind of Cassavetes kind of feel to it. Like, and I love Cassavetes movies and I love, Jenna Rollins. And I think that was kind of my take on that. Yeah. I wanted to do something that felt uncomfortably real and raw and just really dive off the deep end. And I believe we did.
Absolutely. I'm coming in a second to the probably the fourth of these really notable indies with Emily the Criminal. But first, we got to just note the variety of kind of random is maybe not the right word, but other stuff that's going on in the midst of all this. You were a psychiatric patient who has a very hard to describe, again, trajectory on Legion on FX, which if you look already at just a lot of people think this is one of the great TV series of the 21st century. I think even you said it took some a few reads to sometimes know exactly what the hell was going on, but in the, you know, in the best sense. Just and also here, maybe not for the first or last time, like a character that was not in any way intended for you, or even in this case for a woman, right? This was supposed to be a middle-aged man.
Yes, it was. Lenny Busker was a man, was a middle-aged man in the original script, I believe, that Noah Hawley wrote. And yes, I that was the first television show I did after Parks and Rec. I was very, very kind of hesitant about jumping onto another show, but I loved Fargo. I thought Noah Hawley was a brilliant writer, and I met with him, and I thought I was meeting to play the lead, the female lead. But it turns out after my meeting, he thought, you know what, I think he'd be good as Lenny Busker. I'm like, oh, I'm sorry, I didn't read the script. I didn't read those parts. I gotta read those parts again and see right. what the fuck you're talking about. But but then I got really excited about it because but my one kind of thing about it was I started reading thinking, wow, I could do this part, but what's interesting to me about it is to do the part without them changing it at all. And I asked him, like, I'd like to do it, but please don't change the dialogue, because the one thing, one of my pet peeves is when someone, you know, wants you to do something and then they go, but I'm going to rewrite it for you, and you're like, no, just let the character be the character. And he did that. So I thought it was a really, really amazing acting challenge for me, that whole show. And I loved the work that I got to do on it. And it was very trippy, very, very trippy.
The other just completely polar opposite thing before Emily the Criminal is just, I was fortunate to be there in 2019 and 2020 when you hosted the Spirit Awards, which I thought you were hilarious. And I just wonder what, you know, kind of, was that any hesitancy about doing that maybe for the first time, or were you jumping at it? And part B to that question, would you, just putting this out there, if asked, would you be interested in hosting the Oscars?
I would absolutely love to host the Oscars. In fact, I've campaigned in the past to do it, and I hope they take me seriously this coming year. Yeah. Really. I love hosting. I think live television is such a challenge, and it's such a fun challenge. I love, you know, I came up performing on the stage, you know, performing comedy, and I have a deep, deep, deep love for films. And so the Independent Spirit Awards to me was, I wouldn't just host anything. I love to be a host. I like to host parties, but, I wanted to host the Independent Spirit Awards because I felt very connected to that, to the spirit of, no pun intended, but to the spirit of that show. I came up on watching that show. I remember John Waters would host it, you know, years and years in a row. And that was the award show that I cared about the most. I felt honored when they asked me, and I took it really seriously. I love the idea, because I came up in the 90s, you know, and I remember watching, you know, Billy Crystal host the Oscars and Whoopi Goldberg, and you know, they really used to put on a show, and it really used to be all about films. And that's something that I feel like has been lost over the years. Things have become so political over the years. And I love the idea of hosting the show and really keeping it about the films.
Yeah.
You know, I have no interest in, you know, talking about politics on stage. And, you know, of course there's a time and a place for it, but I was interested in having an old school kind of approach. And so, and, you know, and it's a challenge. I got to do sketches. I got to make videos. For me, it was like, this is my own little mini SNL.
It was
great. I didn't know I was going to host SNL at that point. So I thought, fuck it. I'm going to make sketch videos. I'm going to do live show. I'm going to sing. I'm going to do everything. I just want to put on a good show.
I like it.
And I would love to host the Oscars, and I will. I think I will at some point. And
they would be lucky to have you. I mean, that would be awesome. All right. This brings us to your major 2022 part A, Emily the Criminal, art school dropout with massive debt, begins getting entangled in the world of financial crime. Again, you're a producer on this, and just 3 weeks, a real true indie, and it was recognized as a great one with your nominations from the Gotham and Spirit Awards. I think people came away from it with, I don't think you've ever had better response from critics and people than to that. Just what that one, what you hoped it would be, and how you feel it all turned out.
That film, I mean, I've said it before. I believe we made the version of the movie that is closest to what I wanted. I'm so proud of that movie. The script, it was undeniably good. You know, the script, John Patton Ford wrote a great script, and it just, that movie proves to you that if you have a great script and you shoot the script, you're going to be good. We shot the script. That's what I'm most proud of about that movie. We did not compromise. We did not, we did not have a lot of money, but we had a scrappy mentality, and the spirit of the script and the characters really infused into the production process. And it was a true indie, you know, indie team. It was we figured out a way, and I will give a lot of credit to Jeff Bierman, our cinematographer, and John Patton Ford, the director, because the way we shot the movie was really down and dirty style and allowed us to move fast and have minimal lighting setups and to get it done. And I think, you know, our editor, Harrison Atkins, is a genius. And I think it's all about the people you work with. And I think because the script was so great, we assembled a team that was just killer. And I loved it. The minute I read that script years and years ago, I just loved the character. And I just thought, this is an opportunity for me to play somebody that sounds different from me, that doesn't, you know, fall into that trap of whatever the deadpan comedy stuff. This is not a comedy. This is in my mind, a thriller. Yeah. It had everything going for it. And I think it's kind of, there's something, you know, we thought a lot about Straight Time, which is a Dustin Hoffman movie from the 70s, really simple. You know, in the 70s, they used to make movies that, to me, in my opinion, felt more kind of, you know, like almost like you're getting a glimpse into someone's life. They didn't have to, you know, not everything had to be tied up in a neat bow at the end or something. Like, it just was a vibe. And I feel like this had that kind of throwback feeling to it. I think I'm always kind of trying to make movies feel like the movies felt like when I grew up watching them.
Yeah, totally.
Whatever that is.
It was great. And all right, this brings us to the home stretch. We have you playing on season two of The White Lotus, Harper Spiller, employment lawyer on vacation with her newly wealthy husband, Ethan, and another couple, Daphne and Cameron. I know you and Mike White have some history, which I think connects to why you came to be a part of this. But I don't know if this was your or his word, but as close to a quote unquote normie, close quote, as I think you've been asked to play. And you've said as close to yourself in a way as you've been asked to play, right?
I felt that. Yeah, this was very personal for me. Yes, the normie kind of thing was kind of a funny framing that Mike gave me early on. He said, I think it'd be really funny for you to play a normie. And I'm just going, that's interesting. And I think what he meant by that is, you know, when you look at all the characters that I've played a lot of characters that are, you know, criminals, characters that are in mental institutions, characters have a lot of complicated things going on. And so normie, I guess, is, you know, you're just a lawyer, you know, you're right. Just a lawyer. But lawyers aren't normal at all. And I know that on
right.
level. But anyway, so it was I liked the idea of it though. I understood what he was saying by that. And I think, yes, I think like there's, you know, there was a lot of me in that part. And I think the parts of me that I don't necessarily think I've shown in other things, the more vulnerable side, kind of a quieter side that I haven't really, I guess, gotten to explore. I think also like there's a mature kind of, you know, grown up thing going on with those characters. And I think a lot of throughout the years, it's like, you know, and it's typical for most actors, so a lot of times play younger than you really are. And I think people forget, you know, I'm going to be 39 next week. And I think sometimes people still think of me like, oh, I'm like 25, or I was like, no, I'm almost 40, and I've seen a lot of shit. So I think it felt good for me to play someone my actual age, you know, someone that is married and understands the complications of marriage and these things. And I thought a lot about my mom too. My mom is a lawyer. I talked to her a lot about that and kind of these kinds of personalities types that are navigating these situations. So it was personal to me on a lot of levels.
And what did you make when, I mean, I'm sure you've seen and read and heard, you know, there's polarizing reactions to the character. There are people who found her to be, you know, the fun police in a way. On the other hand, seems pretty entitled to be annoyed that her husband is not necessarily attracted to her at the moment. He's dragged her along on a trip with this douchebag and his wife. And just like, I mean, what did you make of the fact that, and what does it say about audiences maybe even that there were such passionate and varying reactions to her?
Yeah. Well, I think it's a success, you know, when there's a dialogue like that happening in terms of reacting to stuff. I think it's you always want passionate responses. You always want people to, you know, it's good when some people hate it and some people love it, and I think that's good. That's all good, because it just means that you're hitting on something, you're hitting on a nerve, you know, you're hitting on something that's affecting people. And I think the thing about Harper, and like, I feel like it's so obnoxious when I always say this in interviews, but I still haven't seen it.
Really?
And I will someday, but I still, no, I mean, I saw the first episode, but, yeah. But I haven't seen it, and I will. But so it's hard for me to know, like, okay, how it was put together, but I know what I did and I know how I felt when I did it. And I think the kind of amazing thing about what Mike wrote and how maybe, you know, the collaboration between what he wrote and what I did is that people related to her on different levels. And there were certain things that I think people felt really like, why would she react this way? Why would she not say anything? Or why would, you know, but I think that there was a relatability with her on a lot of different levels. So I think it was upsetting for people because it felt almost too, yeah, it was just, you know, people felt like, wow, like that's exactly how I would feel, or that's exactly what I would do, or that is not like anything I would do. So right. I think all of that is really good. But I think that Harper, like, I did not like, look, I just had this conversation the other day about likable characters, and we were talking about Deborah Winger and how cool she was and she is, but like how she plays characters that, like, there's not a lot of female characters that can be grumpy, that can be annoyed, that can be whatever they are without having most half the audience go like, you know, this person's a drag. It's like,
right.
No, they're not, you
right.
know,
right.
And also smart, you know, Harper is a smart woman. I think she's smart. She's critical. And I don't think she's among her people. So you're watching someone try to navigate that, and it's uncomfortable.
Right.
But I felt compassion for it all at every step.
With just the last 2 minutes if it's okay. I just really quickly run out the last three things. I guess, I don't know, having not seen the show yet, I don't know if you'll know the full thing of what I'm referring to here, but that whole, obviously you acted it, but I mean, just the way it plays, that scene in Noto where she's engulfed by the sea of men, it's sort of surrealistic and haunting thing. Just briefly, what in your view was that about as you saw it?
Well, I mean, it was, first of all, it was kind of an homage to the Monica Vitti, you know. But I think, so there was a kind of, I think it, in some ways there was a cinematic kind of like nostalgic kind of romantic kind of reminder to the audience of like, this is, you're watching, you know, you're watching a film. I mean, even though it's a TV show, it, to me, it was a film. To me, it was a 7-hour movie. And I think because the way Mike writes, it's like, it feels like a movie to me when you're shooting it. And I just think it there's an elevation there. It reminds the audience like, wow, like this is more than just, you know, TV show that's being shoved down our throats. But I think in terms of the subject matter, like there's different interpretations, but I think that there's something about Italy and Sicily and the culture, you know, of sex and romance and misogyny and all these kinds of things that come up when you think about that, that were all in there somewhere. I guess the last thing I'll say about that sequence is, Italian culture aside, which I think it had a lot to do with that kind of, you see this kind of like serious kind of American like thrown in to this kind of like wild Sicilian culture. And I think I think there's a repressed kind of aspect of Harper that she's struggling with while she's on this vacation, because she's being kind of confronted by this kind of culture that is like loose and sexy and, you know, whatever. And I think it's like, I think there's something, I think you're seeing a woman like, it's just animalistic. I don't know. You're seeing a woman kind of like be confronted by the idea that like, oh, like, you know, there's other things out there that are going on and there's something that you might not be tapped into.
Obviously, the other kind of moment that's very open to interpretation or speculation is what actually happened between Harper and Cameron, if anything, when they went back to the hotel room. Was that something that you wanted to talk to Mike about or your co-star, or did you just make your own decision about that?
I made my own decision about that. There was never a concrete, you know, answer. I don't think Mike is interested in the black and white of those kinds of situations. I think he's interested in the gray area. He wants people to project whatever they're projecting onto it themselves. I mean, I had a clear kind of idea that what I thought was going on, but again, I don't know how it was put together, so I don't know how it was dealt with in the edit and how it came across. But in the scripted version, there's a vagueness to some of those scenes, and you really don't know. I mean, there were things that really shocked me. I remember the day that Will and Megan, Ethan and Daphne were shooting their scene done by Isola Bella, and in my mind there was no sexual element to that scene. I thought, well, they're just having this conversation and she's kind of sweet and they're walking away. And then I remember hearing the crew, or hearing, I can't remember who said it, but they were like, well, they definitely did something in the cave or whatever. And I'm like, what? My husband? No. I remember that very clearly, because I remember going, oh wow, so this stuff is really up for interpretation. Like, It is really up for interpretation. I have no idea.
And the same thing, I guess, you could say about the way we leave Harper and Ethan. They seem to be back together, but you can also read a lot into their expressions, and that might suggest otherwise. And I guess that's a nice thing about the show, that kind of gray area.
Absolutely. And I remember shooting that scene, and, you know, it was, we did not shoot chronologically, so that there was a lot more to do after we shot that. And I was very much felt like, you know, I don't think this is just everything's wrapped up in a bow here and we're and everything's cool. Like, I think there's some lingering kind of things going on here. And that was important to me. I wasn't sure if I communicated that or not, but that's how I felt.
No, totally. Absolutely. Okay, last question. Between Emily the Criminal and The White Lotus, I think if anyone didn't know and admire your work before 2022, 2023, they probably do now. And so for people who may be curious, I know there's a lot of exciting upcoming stuff for you, and I'd like to ask if you can tease it in any way. In particular, I believe on TV, there's the WandaVision sequel for Disney+, part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, Agatha Coven of Chaos. And then in film, Francis Ford Coppola's long-awaited Megalopolis. He obviously does things in his own particular way. He self-financed this one for a lot of money. There have been all sorts of rumblings about it, good, bad, and ugly. So, yeah, with those two in particular, hopefully you can shed some light on what we have to look forward to.
Yes, well, I can tell you that my characters are very different in both of these projects. It was a very, very intense back-to-back situation shooting these things. But the Megalopolis is, oh man, I can't really say much about either of these things. But I can just say that it was an absolute dream come true to work with Francis. I felt like, wow, I've found my director. I found my guy. I felt he loves actors. He loves and respects the process of acting so much that it was just a match made in heaven for me. And the character that we created in that movie is, I don't know, it's unlike anything I've done before. I think people will, even physically, like, I just think people will have to do a double take. I don't think anyone's going to see that one coming. It's epic. That movie is epic. And Coven of Chaos was so fun. I wanted very much to work with Catherine Hahn. I think she's so great. And without saying anything really, I had a blast. I love my character on that as well. And I think it's the most kind of elevated, you know, Marvel material that's out there. So it was cool to jump into that world with those people specifically.
Awesome. Well, I thank you so much for your time. It's been fun watching all your stuff and prepping for this. And I cannot wait for those two. Really a lot to look forward
to. Thanks, Scott. Thank you. Me too.
Thanks very much for tuning into Awards Chatter. We really appreciate you taking the time to do that, and would really appreciate you taking a minute more to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or your podcast app, and to leave us a rating as well. If you have any questions, comments, or concerns, you can reach me via Twitter at twitter.com/ScottFeinberg. Until next time, thanks for joining us.